I'm Bob Franklin, my guest, joining me via telephone from Tucson, Arizona, is Lydia Millett. And we're going to be talking about her interesting opinion article that appeared in the New York Times. It is entitled Native Lives Matter Too. Thank you, Lydia, for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Bob.
Okay. First of all, very interesting topic to your opinion piece, Native Lives Matter Too. What prompted you to write it?
Well, you know, I've been sort of amazed for a long time that more attention hasn't been paid to by sort of the dominant culture, by the mainstream, to what goes on with Native Americans. You know, I feel like there's just been this neglect in the media broadly. You know, the stories of Indian lives today. And, of course, there are all sorts of great Indian media outlets that you can read. But when I looked in major papers and, you know, looked around for television coverage of all the stuff going on in the American Indian communities across our country, I just saw so little reference to them outside that Indian media. And I thought it was something that, you know, something that deserved attention. The first time I wrote about matters concerning American Indians was actually an op-ed that I wrote on the San Carlos Apaches' fight to save Oak Flat from mining, which is, you know, Oak Flat being a sacred site of the San Carlos Apache here in Arizona. So that was the first piece that I wrote for the New York Times about Indian matters, and just more recently, I wrote also about police violence against Native Americans.
I'm also interested in, and I'm going to come back to your point a second ago, but I want to also ask you, you said that you wanted your piece to run on Columbus Day. Why?
Well, you know, it just seemed to me that that would be the perfect day because, of course, of all the very complicated and problematic issues associated with celebrating Columbus Day. So that would be a perfect day for this piece, which wants to bring attention to the sort of tragic violence that plays out against American Indians and Alaska Natives as well. That would be the perfect day. Unfortunately, it didn't run till the day after, but, you know, close enough, I guess.
As a student, let's go back to some of your formative years, high school, college. How much emphasis did your textbooks and your coursework prepare you for the experience or history of Native Americans? How prepared were you about Native American life and their predominance here in the Americas?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I actually grew up in Toronto, in Canada. And so it's kind of different up there, although, you know, not entirely different, but relationships between whites and First Nations up there are a little different. I mean, it's hard to generalize, but it's a different country, you know. But I had some education. I think it was actually later, though. I don't think it was really school that taught me about Indians in contemporary life.
What?
I mean, I saw movies. You know, I saw movies that were made by white people, some of which were interesting and good in certain ways, and others of which were problematic. You know, you think of Dustin Hoffman starring in A Little Big Man, that movie from, I believe, the 70s, where he actually plays an Indian, Dustin Hoffman, you know. But it's actually quite a powerful film. And then, you know, anyway, so you see these representations in popular culture if you're a white person, and you don't know much real about Indian life. And, you know, in many ways, I still don't know much real about Indian life in America today. You know, I'm not an expert on any of this stuff. I just happen to have a platform in the New York Times where I get to write op-eds. And it seemed to me that this needed to be said. These things just simply need to be said right now by anyone about the situation. Specifically, this op-ed about the situation with police violence against against Indians. As you may know, Indians make up about 1% of the U.S. population, American Indians, obviously, and but they account for about 2% of police killings, and that's a pretty frightening statistic.
Well, we're going to talk about police interaction with Native Americans and other minority groups in a minute. Is there in your op-ed a call to action?
There is. I mean, that's really what my op-eds generally are calls to action. And this one wants to say, we cannot turn our faces away from how American Indians are treated, what their lives are like now. We have a history of having oppressed, subjugated, and indeed annihilated Native people, and our country is built on a mass grave of the Native people that lived in this land before the white people came. And, we clearly need to do far more to acknowledge that in our daily lives and, act to correct what we can, what's still wrong now. And, of course, it's very complicated. There are no simple answers. But I do think that the dominant culture owes such a profound debt to American Indian, peoples and cultures that it's one that can never be repaid. But we really need to step up our game and pay attention to what's going on. That's the first step.
What's been the response to your op-ed? I would be interested to know, as well as our listeners, what's been the response you've received?
Well, people have been generally, I don't actually read the comments on the New York Times website, so I can't speak to that. But I've gotten a lot of emails that have been very kind and actually very, a lot of appreciation just for having written about this in a well-trafficked forum. That's the thing that these op-eds can give you that are in the New York Times are a lot of readers. And so I've had great emails from people of all races, colors, and creeds, supporting this and saying, well, we're really glad that someone said this. It needed to be said in a high-profile place. It wasn't being said in a high-profile place. And so, yeah, it's been great, actually. The emails, getting emails from people, it's just one of the best things about writing these pieces.
Well, let's go inside your piece, your op-ed piece, titled Native Lives Matter Too, and you cite several incidents that I'd like for you to just give us a surface understanding, although there are many other examples other than the three I'd like to have you comment on. You cite several incidents in South Dakota involving Sarah Lee Circlebear, Alan Locke, and one in Oklahoma, Christina Talahalua of the Comanche mm-hmm. tribe. Would you talk briefly about those incidents and police reaction and non-action in those three examples, please?
Well, sure. Actually, Sarah Lee Circlebear was the case that started me looking into all of this and researching this stuff this summer, because my mother somehow saw a story about her online, and it was a very mysterious incident. And, when I contacted the local authorities, now what had happened was that she had been arrested, I believe, along with her boyfriend. This was a young mother of two, 24-year-old Lakota mother of two. And she had been, I think it was a traffic stop. She was taken to jail on a bond violation. And then at a certain point in custody, she began experiencing a lot of pain. Bystanders said that she cried out for help and was ignored. But those I don't believe, I couldn't find the evidence to corroborate that, to actually put it in the op-ed. But that's what the report was, and that's what sort of alerted me to the case. And then they basically didn't take her to the hospital till 2 hours after she began crying out in pain, and I believe she was dead on arrival, as far as I recall. And so this got almost no attention. No one looked at what happened here. It just was sort of brushed under the rug. That was Sarah Lee Circlebear. And she did die of an overdose of methamphetamines, and there's just a question about how did she get them into the jail? No one seems to know. Was she somehow given them in jail? Just a lot of doubt around what exactly happened, a lot of murkiness in the reporting, you know, and we should know more about this, and there should be more transparency around what happened to this young woman. And then the second one I think you asked me about was Alan Locke. This was a 30-year-old Lakota man who actually one day after he went and protested at a Native Lives Matter rally, specifically against police violence, he was shot dead by the police. He was holding a steak knife at the time he was hit, they say, most reports say, by 5 bullets, and the shooting was deemed justified. And, you know, there are a lot of details to some of these stories, but in none of them is it clear that everything went down the way that it should have, right? I mean, and then I think that the last one you asked me about was Christina, and there were sort of different reports on what happened with her too. But this was in November of 2014 in Oklahoma, and she was in police custody, and she also died, and there are reports of her having been tased for refusing to stop singing Comanche hymns, although the police deny this rationale. But she was another one who died, and there was quite an outpouring of support and outrage after her death. So it did get a little more press than Sara Lee Circlebear, for example, did. But it's still not clear why she had to die.
And in all these instances, the police had some degree of involvement. Do you think that the media, in its coverage of, or lack thereof, of these events, described events and others, is more or less interested in sensationalism or more inclined to be critical of the police? If you could choose between the two, or maybe there might be some other reason that you might have as it relates to the lack of coverage of the aforementioned incidents?
I think in a lot of these cases, it's really hard for journalists to get the whole story from the police and from inside the justice system. I'm not really clear why it's so difficult. Maybe partly because, you know, these events are not happening in big cities. It's a lot of times small town, you know, sheriff's departments that are involved in some of these incidents, you know, because as I'm sure some of your listeners are fully aware, there aren't huge concentrated populations of American Indians in a lot of cities in the U.S. I mean, New York has a little over 100,000 American Indians living there. L.A. is number two with about 50,000, but generally you don't have these large communities within big cities of Indians, and so you don't have the same kind of microscope on rural life in this country, the same kind of media microscope that you do, you know, on urban life. It's just the way it is. So there's something there as well. It's not all cut and dried. There's something to the fact that, you know, only a fifth of Native Americans live on reservations. So the other four-fifths are sort of more dispersed around the country than, for example, African Americans are, in terms of, you know, being isolated, really. So, yeah, I do think there's an element of geography in the way media is responding to some of these accounts, you know, as well. But I couldn't tell you whether... I couldn't really, you know, point fingers. I just think that more attention needs to be paid to a very systemic pattern of violence against people who really shouldn't have to deal with any more adversity in their lives.
My next point will be Black Lives Matters, that particular movement, as compared to Native American lives. I want to compare it to, which is may not be a good comparison, but we will compare that. But I'm just curious about you as a journalist, an op-ed writer, as a human being. What type of impact has this coverage of Native Americans, injustice at the hands of police. That's my characterization of it. Has it had any type of impact on you personally, professionally, or otherwise?
No. I mean, in the sense that I personally am not involved in this, and I've never been the victim of police violence. I'm a white woman, middle-class white woman. Actually, not a journalist. I'm a novelist who just happens to have, right now, a column in the New York Times. I'm also a conservationist, so I write about issues across the West and sometimes other issues. So, no, I don't have any personal involvement. This is just something that I saw was happening, and there was no one else in, you know, for example, the New York Times specifically writing about this, and or in any of the other major papers or news outlets around the country, except for Simon Moya-Smith, who does work for CNN, who's a very prominent activist and journalist. So he's been writing about it, but and I read a lot of his articles and his coverage, which are great. It just wasn't out there. So I wanted to correct that. That's all, in a small way, by running this piece.
All lives matters, and there's the slogan "Black Lives Matters." And I'm just curious. You reference the fact that blacks in America represent about 45 million. Native Americans have a smaller number, and that Black Lives Matters movement is certainly concentrated in urban areas, urban centers. Therefore, when the information about police actions against blacks, African Americans, have been captured, then there's a great deal of coverage by the media, and not so much with regard to Native American lives. How do you compare the two, other than one is more urban and the other is more rural, possibly, or smaller in numbers? And on top of that, the power of social media, because social media capturing this information and then getting it to on the internet and to a cross section of viewers has really actually helped to push media coverage. So what do you think?
Well, I just think that different communities and cultures have different ways of interacting with all these, you know, with, for example, with technology, with the sort of the communication system that we have now, including social media and all that. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement has been very powerful recently, very, very successful at drawing attention to, you know, to the tragedies that occur, in black communities. I just think it's been extraordinarily successful. And, of course, there are much, much bigger numbers of black Americans than American Indians. And that's part of it, too. But, I think that, that it's not always easy for Native Americans to interact with the dominant culture, with the white or largely white mainstream. It's been difficult for them, and there are cultural differences that make it hard, perhaps at times, for them to be as visible as, for example, Black Lives Matter has recently been. And I think it's great that both these movements are, because there is a Native Lives Matter movement, and it's great that both these movements are getting traction.
Do you think the rural nature of reservations, location of reservations, and the digital divide, the lack of technology, might also hamper Native communities, Native Americans getting their message out to a wider audience with regard to incidents involving police and other matters? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know what, the statistics are, and I'm sure some of your panelists will discuss this, but I don't know what the statistics are on sort of tech and the amount of tech specifically on the reservations. But again, 80% of Indians don't live on reservations. And so I don't know to what degree, technological disparities are at the root of this. I'm sure they do play a role.
In your article, you mentioned the high poverty rate among Native Americans, the high infant mortality rate as well. That seems to be growing in many minority groups around the country. You cite Native Americans. The impact of those two from your research on Native American population, would you care to elaborate a bit?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? I'm not sure what the question was there.
Sure. Talk about the poverty rate among Native Americans, as you cite in your article, as well as the high infant mortality rate that you also state or elaborate in your article.
Yeah, well, you know, Indians have the highest poverty rate of any group in the country. About one in three Indians live, you know, beneath the federal poverty line. So that's about 29%, I believe, of Indians lived in poverty in 2013. So that's extraordinary. That means Indians are the poorest people in the United States, and of course there are going to be many, many other social ills that accompany the kind of, you know, income inequality that's at play here.
Back to your article again, you stated that Native Americans were a targeted minority. Did you mean by police, society, or how did you mean that in your op-ed piece?
Yeah, in this context, I just meant that they are the victims of police violence at such a high level, more than any other group, actually. So that's what I was specifically talking about, not any grander conspiracy in this case.
Understood. Stereotyping, we've talked a bit about suspicion of minorities, Native Americans, and others. How would you suggest, and this was not in your article, that we as a society, and this is a big question, deal with, you know, stereotyping and being suspicious of the other, those who are different than the dominant group? How would you suggest individuals go about breaking down those barriers that force people into stereotyping and being suspicious of the other?
Well, I think the burden is always on the majority to reach out to the minority personally. The burden is on the powerful to hold their hand out to the less powerful. That's how I see it. And so what we can do, if we as sort of, again, as the dominant culture, as the mainstream, those with power, say, although I don't really consider myself to have power personally, what we need to do is, you know, we need to take responsibility for the fact that this oppression is taking place, that we play a role in it, and we need to simply do our best not to look at people categorically in primitive terms. I mean, it's a very primitive, in a bad way, primitive way of looking at people, to see them as just representative of a category. It's you know, of course, very ignorant. And I think it's quite easy for young people now to look beyond all that stuff. And I think maybe the older people have some catching up to do, because you certainly don't see a lot of, you know, really young people, say the millennials or whatever, you know, having the same kind of rampant bigotry that has existed, you know, in past decades against minority groups. And so maybe on a personal level, maybe old people who are in these powerful groups could take a look at, you know, how some of the younger people are doing with regard to identity politics and minorities, and just sort of rising above all that and being inclusive.
I'm Bob Franklin. My guest is Lydia Millett, and she's a contributing op-ed writer for the New York Times. She's also a novelist. Her novel, Mermaids in Paradise. We've been speaking today about her op-ed piece, Native Lives Matters Too. And Lydia, as we roll toward the end of the program, maybe one more big picture type of question. Historically, though, some lives are valued more than other lives. And maybe that's an indictment on the system, but what can we start to do, in your view, to really look at individuals as people who we can respect, whether they are of one national group, Native group, or another minority group? How can we look at individuals and see value and respect toward those individuals who have different characteristics than our own? What would you suggest?
Well, I think the most obvious, simplest thing to do is just to know each other better. Once we know each other, fear goes away. You know, fear is caused by ignorance most times. And so, you know, if we just reach out and get to know each other, I think that's the right way to go.
Do you believe your op-ed piece is that step, that one step in the right direction, which is calling to action of individuals, for individuals to make that step outside of their comfort zone?
I hope so. It's a baby step, but other people out there are doing even more, and I will watch them with great interest.
Well, as long as the step is in a positive direction, I think you've made a great contribution to the cause. My guest has been Lydia Millett, contributing op-ed writer for the New York Times. Her article, her op-ed article, Native Lives Matters Too, we've been discussing today. Lydia, thank you for your time and all of your great work at the New York Times.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Absolutely. Take good care. We'll talk with you again.
Okay, Bob. Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.